You're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP, Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and this is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with the author Robert Boswell, whose novel Tumbleweed was released as a paperback in September by Grey Wolf Press. Robert Boswell has published 7 novels, 3 story collections, and 2 books of nonfiction. He has had 2 plays produced. His work has earned him 2 National Endowment for the Arts Fellowships, a Guggenheim Fellowship, the Iowa School of Letters Award for Fiction, a Lila Wallace Woodrow Wilson Fellowship, the Penn West Award for Fiction, the John Gassner Prize for Playwriting, and the Evil Companions Award. The heyday of the Insensitive Bastards was a finalist for the 2010 Penn USA Award in Fiction. When Men Call Treasure was a finalist for the Western Writers of America Nonfiction Spur Award. Both the Chicago Tribune and Publishers Weekly named Mystery Ride as one of the best books of the year. The London Independent picked The Geography of Desire as one of the best books of the year. Virtual Death was a finalist for the Philip K. Dick Award and was named by the Science Fiction Chronicle as one of the best novels of the year. Robert Boswell has published more than 70 stories and essays. They have appeared in The New Yorker, Best American Short Stories, O. Henry Prize Stories, Pushcart Prize Stories, Esquire, Colorado Review, Epic, Plowshares, and many other magazines and anthologies. He holds the Cullen Endowed Chair in Creative Writing at the University of Houston. He lives in Houston, Texas, Las Cruces, New Mexico, and Telluride, Colorado. He also spends time in a ghost town in the Rockies, high in the Rockies. Robert Boswell's novels are Tumble Down, Centuries, Sun, American Owned Love, Mystery Ride, The Geography of Desire, and Crooked Hearts. His story collections are The Heyday of the Insensitive Bastards, Living to be 100, Dancing in the Movies. His nonfiction, The Half-Known World, A Book on the Craft of Writing, and What Men Call Treasure, The Search for Gold at Vittorio Peak, a book about a treasure hunt in New Mexico, co-written with David Schweidel. His cyberpunk novel, Virtual Death, was published under the pseudonym Shale Aaron. His plays are Tongues and The Long Shrift. The Long Shrift opened off Broadway in July 2014. So when I spoke with Robert Boswell in October, I started by bringing up the sheer number of characters in his novel Tumble Down, and I asked him to talk about developing so many individuals, and I asked if it's ever difficult for him to keep so many balls in the air, so to speak, both in their unique personalities and also in the distinctiveness of their reactions and relationships to one another.
Well, it was very difficult. I worked on the novel for 10 years, and some of the characters are modeled after people I knew and someone I used to be. But as I moved forward, they became less and less the actual humans that I knew and more the creations I needed them to be. And as you might be able to imagine, after 10 years, they don't resemble the actual people much at all. For example, I had one character who was a maintenance man, and he was modeled after someone who was a friend of mine. And he had a specific role to play in the novel, but as the novel changed, that role vanished, and I realized at some point I didn't really need him, except there were a couple scenes that I could not cut those scenes. So I wound up combining that character with another character in order to not to add a character who was merely there for some functionary reason. That changed the first character in big ways, which changed every scene that character was in, but ultimately improved the novel. So it's a funny thing when you write a book that is based in part on real events, the people who were a part of that world look and they think they see themselves or my version of them, and they'll say something to me, and it may baffle me because I've forgotten it was originally based on them. That happened to me a number of times, and I think it's something that frequently happens to fiction writers.
Well, do you think sometimes people are misreading it and seeing themselves when they really weren't ever there also?
Frequently that happens.
Yeah, okay.
And I don't think any family likes having a writer in the mix.
Yeah.
I think we're very annoying creatures to have around. And the same goes, for friends. With a different book, I had someone approach me one time, and she said she was upset about the portrayal of her in the novel. And it took me a while to remember, oh, yeah, there is a character modeled loosely after her. And then she started talking, I realized she wasn't thinking about that character, but a different character.
I suppose that's not how you defended yourself.
I just let it go, you know.
Yeah.
I just said, I'm sorry. And that really is, I think, the appropriate answer. I think it is a drag to have a writer in the family. And I think it is discomforting to see some version of experiences you've been through filtered through a specific point of view and put on the page, not in order to capture what happened, but to capture the best story that can get at some kind of truth that may or may not really have anything to do with the actual events.
Okay, great. Well, speaking of some kind of truth, I wanted to ask you about the subject of beauty in this novel. There's a lot about beauty, and in particular, sort of most obviously, I enjoyed your descriptions of the character Carly's beauty and another character Maura's plainness. And the way their looks are presented made me think about, you know, how characters in novels and movies and television shows are always, often, are beautiful without any further exploration or development. And in this case, that's not the case. There's a lot of development and exploration of beauty, and Carly's beauty is combined with a very low IQ because of an accident when she was a child. She has a very low IQ. Anyway, I wondered if we can talk a little bit about this, and also one specific thing I noticed, which was that you employ this cliche to describe Carly early on. You say that Candler cannot come up with anything else in his mind other than the expression drop-dead gorgeous. And I just wondered if you did that on purpose, because sometimes we don't see past beauty beyond the cliche, or if I'm just reading too much into that. So,
well, with Carly, that's exactly what I'm up to. I mean, there is a, and she is someone who is modeled after a character, a client that I had.
Okay.
A young woman who was very, very beautiful, but due to, and was not born mentally impaired, but had something happened to her when she was very young. And so, because she was not born with a mental impairment, she didn't have the typical physical attributes or physical tics that give that away.
Right.
Her movement was the kind of movement you would expect from anyone with a normal IQ, and so on and so forth. So it fascinated me, you know, what does beauty mean, and how do we measure it, and what do we mean when we talk about superficial beauty and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And I did want to explore it actually with pretty much all the characters. Carly is probably the most obvious one because of her the specifics of her life, but I tried to look at it with all the characters. There's a character named Lolly who reinvents herself frequently in her life, and so I'm questioning the idea of identity and beauty. we have this strange, we have this very strange obsession with beauty in the culture. I think an interest in beauty is necessary and important, and trying to understand and define what it means. But the culture, it seems to me, has a very narrow, specific, and unfortunate idea about physical beauty, and especially physical beauty in young women and young men,
mm-hmm.
that I think is destructive, I guess. And I wanted to explore it and try to get at a new definition, I guess. Not by making a statement somewhere in the novel, although there are some thoughts of characters that approach statement, but by presenting a narrative argument about what beauty is.
Yeah. Yeah, and in a way it just makes readers think more about what beauty means to them if they notice this in the book. Would you agree?
I hope so.
Yeah.
I hope that happens. When you mentioned Maura, Maura is a character who all her life has felt unattractive, and since coming to this residential treatment facility have lost weight. One of the elements that the culture is obsessed with, of course,
mm-hmm.
and but still understands that she sees Carly every day. She still understands that she is no beauty, according to the conventional definition. And she's also vulgar, and she's angry, and she makes some poor decisions, but ultimately she's one of my favorite characters
yeah.
in the novel, and I think there there's this beauty that resides within her that I believe is quite large and powerful and magnificent. I love her as a character. She's one of my favorites.
Yeah, she's great. She's very funny too. In her vulgarity, and despite her vulgarity, a lot of times she's very, very funny. So you just said something about her poor choices, and it reminds me of something I was going to ask you, which is, do you ever dread putting a character in harm's way, or making it, or do you ever make a change because you want this character's life to turn out easier? I know that sounds silly, but we become so attached to these people. Is that ever a temptation to you, for you?
Well, it's a very common problem that I see in, I teach creative writing, it's very a common problem I see in student stories that
yeah.
they fall in love with their characters and then they want to protect them.
Yeah.
And I had the same problems with my early work. I just didn't want anything too bad to happen to them. That's a really good trait to have as a human being, and a really bad one to have as a writer.
Yeah.
As a writer, you've got to be willing to put them in very tough situations and not let them out of it until they've acted, you know, until they've faced what is often the most difficult thing they have to face. I have this belief that your job as a fiction writer is to say the hardest thing about your character, to really get at who they are right down to their soul. And that almost always means putting them in situations that demand a great deal of them and that are harsh.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Is there anything that when you're going to sit down to write, is there any sort of plot twist or character development aspect that you know is going to be hardest for you personally? Maybe not that, but something else. Like, what creates maybe the largest challenge for you?
Well, I would say generally it's when I'm trying to face something that is powerful on the page because it's powerful to me.
Yeah.
And that means I've got to look at my own life with that cold-hearted objectivity and say, my you really messed this up, you know, when you were whatever age, and now you have to own up to it on the page.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, writers often talk about how hard it is to write a book, and writer's block, you know, we're the only profession that has a term for failing. There's no architect's block. No, it's just writer's block, and the reason it's there is because it's so frequent. And I think part of the reason it happens so often is that we lose courage. You have to keep creating characters that permit you to mine your own weaknesses, examine your own failures, look at those parts of your character that are ugly.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it's hard to do.
Yeah.
So that's not the only reason the writer's block is such a phenomenon, but it's one of the reasons.
Okay. In preparing for this interview, I read a lot about Tumble Down, which has actually been out for a while and is just going to paperback, I think, last month. And in a lot of the interviews, you talk about the narrative perspective of Tumble Down. And I want to talk about that. But before we get to that, I want to talk a little bit about omniscience, the narrative perspective of omniscience, just regular omniscience. I know some writing friends who are very comfortable in third-person close narrative voice, and then they have trouble finding an omniscient voice that flows comfortably. So I thought we could talk a tiny bit first about just regular omniscience. Is that anything you've encountered in teaching your students, this difficulty in writing omniscience?
It is, and there are a number of reasons for it. Some of them are philosophical, and some of them are just craft issues. In terms of craft, the close third person is a lot easier to handle
mm-hmm.
than omniscient voice. And there are some obvious reasons for that, and some reasons you only understand once you sit down and try it. The obvious reason is if you're sticking to one person's point of view, you're almost writing, you know, in the third person, just changing the pronouns. I mean, in the first person, just changing the pronouns.
Mm-hmm.
When you switch to omniscience, you have the power to move into any character's point of view. You have the power to make blanket statements, either about the character or about the nature of the world or anything you want. And that not only makes it difficult to manage because you're multiplying the number of characters you have to track, it's also difficult just in terms of how you negotiate the movement from one character to another so that the reader stays located and is not confused and still feels like she is in a story that has direction.
Yeah.
And so that's very hard to manage. Philosophically, some people seem to believe that writing from the omniscient point of view is making some sort of tacit argument that there is a God.
Okay.
Because who else could have that kind of vision and understanding? I don't buy that argument. I believe that what we're trying to do is tell a story, and I'm fascinated with point of view and fascinated with omniscience, and I play with it a great deal. In most of the work I've done in the past 15 years, point of view is my jumping off point very frequently. I will try various kinds of experiments. I have one story called No River Wide, and the first line is both things first. and it tells the story of this woman's life, taking two points in time and presenting them simultaneously. And there's a reason for that in the story, and I had to work very hard to make it relatively easy to follow. But it all had to do with point of view, and it all has to do with omniscience. Obviously, one couldn't tell that story otherwise.
And say the first line again. I didn't quite catch it.
Both things first.
Oh, okay. Huh, interesting.
Other than, yeah.
And that's No River Wide.
Yeah, that's in my last story collection, The Heyday of the Insensitive Bastards.
Okay. All right, great. So let's go ahead and talk about this term that you coined after writing Tumble Down, which is unreliable omniscience, which is really interesting. How did you come up with that, and why, I guess?
Well, it grew out of my work on this novel. As I said earlier, I worked on this novel for 10 years.
Yeah.
It's based in part on my time as a counselor. I have a degree in counseling, a graduate degree in counseling. My area of specialty was in testing. So I would, other counselors would send me their clients. I would have them for either a few days or a few weeks. I would give them a battery of tests, intelligence tests, interest tests. I would also test their fine motor skills, their gross motor skills. I would put them on simulated workstations. I did all kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
At the end of that time, I would write a report and send that report to the client's counselor. And you can imagine how helpful that is if you're dealing with someone who, let's say, had been a welder, now has hurt his back and he can't weld anymore, and he wants to go to college. Well, you really have no way of knowing whether he's college material or not.
Mm-hmm.
And I could write a report that would say, you know, there's a very good chance that he could do well in college, and here are the areas of study that make the most sense. Or I could say he does not have the temperament to sit still in a classroom, and he'd be better off studying something very specific, and here are my recommendations, so on and so forth. What the trouble I ran into is that the counselors who sent their clients to me started believing either that my reports were omniscient or that the test scores themselves were omniscient.
Yeah.
And I knew they weren't. And, you know, if you look at the way the educational system runs in this country, especially after the No Child Left Behind initiative,
mm-hmm.
We rely on test scores, and we treat them as if they are omniscient. You know, schools even have to depend on those scores to get funding. It's absurd.
Yeah.
And it seems to me that the idea of unreliable omniscience is something that right now is at the core of our culture. So test scores, that's one indication, but once you start looking for it, there are all kinds of examples of unreliable omniscience.
Mm-hmm.
The nightly news. People who look at the nightly news and feel that they're getting straightforward, reliable, unbiased information that is essentially, it's treated as if it were omniscient, I think they're being fooled. I think they're fooling themselves. Another example, a simpler example, is the GPS system in our cars.
Yeah.
I'm talking to you right now from Telluride, Colorado, and I have friends who rely on their GPS system to get up here, and they call me and say, I don't think I can come. This road is just too difficult because the GPS has sent them off on some four-wheel drive road to get here. And they're driving a Prius or something. So,
right.
I one time in Portland had, I needed to get to a gas station and, it sent me to the nearest gas station, but it was, for natural gas, not for gasoline. So that seems to me another example of unreliable omniscience. And once you start looking for it, there are all kinds of them. And,
And you do play around with some of those examples in the book, which is fun, too. So
I do play around with them. From the very first paragraph, I try to introduce this idea of a narrator who is on the one hand omniscient in a very large way, and on the other hand is going to be a little tricky, and is going to have some fun with the reader.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I remember you say that you use the word, or your narrator uses the word manacle, the way bedroom communities manacle a city. There's a lot of judgment there, you know, and the stucco house snouted by a two-car garage. Those are both early in the, like, first page, and I loved those. I don't know if that's what you're talking about, but just sort of an opinionated omniscient voice. So.
Well, I feel like an omniscient voice always has to be opinionated, even
okay.
if it's reliable. If you look at Tolstoy, who's perhaps one of the greatest practitioners of omniscience, in his story, The Death of Ivan Illich, at one point he says that Ivan Illich's life was most simple and most ordinary and therefore most terrible.
Okay, yeah, right.
Incredibly judgmental. And it makes sense. If you know everything, you're bound to have opinions.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, it's funny when you were saying before that philosophically the omniscient voice sometimes makes people feel like you're making a comment about God. Certainly in this, you are sort of playing with that, aren't you, with this unreliable omniscience, the idea of the philosophical argument for or against it.
Well, I'm not necessarily making an argument about the existence of God.
No, I know. Just
I'm making an argument, I think, about the existence of omniscience as a belief in the culture, and I think we believe in all kinds of things. I know when there have been times when some national leader has been trying to convince us that a war was necessary, and we're told that there are bombs that can that have such pinpoint accuracy that no one but evildoers will be killed.
Mm-hmm.
And later on, of course, we find out that that is baloney. But we choose to believe in the omniscience of technology quite frequently in our lives.
Right. Well, it's a great relief. It's a great relief to have the difficult decisions removed from our personal control, isn't it? To be told that everything's going to be all right because this greater force knows what to do.
It's very comforting. Yes, it's very comforting.
Yeah.
To be told they are evil and we are good.
Yeah.
Or that God is on our side, or so on and so forth. There are all kinds of omniscient statements that go out there that we want to believe in.
Yeah. How would you say the unreliability affects the voice of omniscience in this book? And one example I think of is that there were certain sections that, to me, sounded a little bit like test speak, where you talked about how you used to give these tests to students. So that's one example, but can you think of other examples of how the unreliability affected the voice?
Well, I think it affected in a number of ways. The novel is actually pretty funny. Or at least
yeah.
I hope
it definitely
and
is.
And there are places, there's one place, for example, where I say, here are things that were omitted from the earlier chapter.
Yes, right.
And I make a list. And very clearly, you have to have an omniscient narrator to do something like that.
Right. Here's all the information you didn't have to make an informed decision, sort of thing.
Right. And then, Carly, because she is mentally impaired, you know her IQ. So if you know her IQ, it seems only fair to the unreliable omniscient narrator that you should know everyone else's.
Yeah, right.
So you know the IQ of all the other characters and other people who just happen to be mentioned, such as the President of the United States and a number of other people, their IQs are in there. So I have a lot of fun with it. It was a strange novel to write, but it was very entertaining.
Yeah. Now,
demanding.
You said it took 10 years. So is this particularly unusual for you? I mean, is that a long time even for your normal novels?
Yeah, you know, my novels take longer and longer to write. The first novel took 2 years. The novel just before Tumbledown took me about 5 years to write, and Tumbledown took 10. So things are just taking longer, I guess. That's not the only reason it took longer. I published 3 other books during those 10 years.
Yeah, I was going to ask. Okay.
That I worked on. And I've got another novel now that I just sent off yesterday to a friend to read and try to give me some kind of perspective on. So I worked on it for 10 years, but I was working on a lot of things at once.
Okay. All right. I want to talk a little bit about writing about mental illness, writing about people who've been diagnosed with a mental illness. And I feel like one potential problem or difficulty as the writer of this material would be relying on the illness to explain away actions, or relying on a lack of normalcy or a lack of rules that people, supposedly healthy people, follow to explain away the actions. Does this ring any bells for you, having written about the patients in Tumbledown?
Absolutely. Explanation is the thing that a fiction writer has to avoid concerning any of the characters.
Mm-hmm.
And it's especially true with characters who come with a built-in diagnosis, because you can't ignore it, but you can't lean on it either. I am someone who resists the easy explanations that are actually really popular right now, you know?
Yeah.
So you hear about a person, and then there's says, well, when he was 5 years old, this happened to him, and therefore that explains what he's doing when he's 35 years old.
Yeah.
Well, my belief is, no, it doesn't explain anything. It may give you some insight into that character, but it doesn't explain anything. So I'm quite aware that avoiding explanation is my job as mm-hmm. a fiction writer. When you have a character whose actions are mysterious, that character is large and may be quite powerful, and if you explain why that character's actions are mysterious, then the character becomes small. The character becomes no larger than that explanation, and that makes the character dismissible, I think.
Yeah, that would be what I was thinking would be hard. You have to try and create a believable narrative. You have these diagnoses that exist, but you don't want to stereotype by diagnosis either, I would think. So, yeah, that must have been a challenge.
Well, it is a real challenge. If you have, it happens all the time in real life. You're dealing with someone and talking to a friend about the difficulty of dealing with that person, and the friend says, well, I think she's bipolar, as if that's all you need to know in order to move forward. Well, I really dislike that kind of argument. I say if she's bipolar, then she needs to be on certain drugs, so on and so forth. What you actually mean is she's moody. I don't like those psychological labels that have become a part of the culture. It's jargon, and
yeah.
I distrust it, and I especially distrust it when it's meant to provide a label in order for us to be able to dismiss that character's opinions or make it easier to do what you want and simply put that person aside.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I have another question about the mental illness piece of the book. I'll tell you a really quick story first, and that is that a few years ago I started to write an essay about the way that vocabulary changes with time, and that the words that we maybe were allowed to use or nobody thought anything about it when we were young now are no longer acceptable. And the essay grew out of this moment where I used the word retarded and then realized that, in fact, that's not a word we use anymore. So I started to write an essay about this. And just addressing the topic in an essay, I was criticized for being offensive. So, and now we aren't talking about my essay and nobody's seen it. So, but I'm curious, like, have you received any negative reactions from people about addressing a mental illness in this book? And do you focus much on that kind of reaction, if so?
I've actually received the opposite. I've received a surprising number of letters and emails and so on from people who have in their family people with mental illness, people who are mentally impaired, and I've also received a lot of wonderful notes from people who have been diagnosed at one time in their lives as being schizophrenic or something of that nature, and they said that the novel seems to approach the way it felt and their experiences, that the novel approaches it honestly and captures it in ways that seem true. And that has been enormously, I'm very grateful for those letters. Because it's a very difficult topic to deal with. When I was a counselor, mentally retarded was in fact the diagnosis. That was the official term.
Mm-hmm.
That diagnosis, that term has since been deemed pejorative. So they now say mentally impaired. Language is interesting, you know, the way language changes over time. I suspect that if mentally impaired remains the term at some point in the future, that will be a pejorative term.
Right.
Because once it becomes part of the culture, then it's used by all parts of the culture, including kids on playground.
Yeah.
You know, and we know how cruel kids on the playground can be, and so terms that are initially neutral become charged in negative ways frequently.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But to answer your question, because I haven't really answered your question, no, I really haven't received criticism for that, and I'm happy to say that I've received a lot of positive response from it instead.
Right, and there are good reasons for that. It's an incredibly wonderful depiction of this population, and I think your 10 years were spent making them very real, complete characters. So, when you do, I'm sorry.
I was going to say that was one of the real challenges. I wanted to write not only from the counselor's point of view, but also from the client's point of view, and I worked very hard to try to get inside those characters and try to understand what it feels like. And that was maybe the most interesting challenge for me of writing this book.
Yeah, and I just felt like they're humanized by your portrayal. You know, I think that rather than being, I think that mentally impaired populations are often just sort of like placed in a box, like we were talking about before with the stereotyping, and these are individuals. Each of these characters is very much his or her own person, and it's really a pleasure to read about each of them. So.
Well, it's interesting. They're often displayed in stereotyped negative ways, and they're also often displayed in stereotyped positive ways, as if they were all angels of God. And
yeah.
I find both of those condescending and dishonest.
Yeah. I think part of what I enjoyed so much about the depiction of these people is the humor, particularly as they interact with each other and the banter that goes back and forth between them, and how each of their personalities comes out as they interact with each other. That was really fun also. Okay. I'm curious, are you a perfectionist? Would you say that you're a perfectionist in your writing?
I'm obsessed. I revise, you know, everything 30, 40, 50, 100 times, even Tumbledown, which is, it was about 500 pages in manuscript. It's 400 some pages, I believe, printed. It's not simply that I'm trying to write better sentences, although certainly that's part of it. It's also my means of making discovery and moving deeper into the narrative. I have this belief that the only way I can get away from the sort of simple stereotype types of story that we're all familiar with is to keep going back to the characters, to keep moving away from the familiar. And my means of doing that is by revising over and over and over again and trying to make discoveries.
And so, given that approach, how do you know when you're done, or is that not something you can really answer because it's specific to each project?
I can't answer it. You never know when you're done. You know, I went on reading tour when the hardback came out, and by the end of that tour, I was reading the first chapter, and I read it over and over again. By the end of that tour, I had revised that first chapter quite significantly and made a lot of cuts. After I sold the book, I worked with my editor, and then she made some, you know, very smart suggestions, and I wound up writing, I think, another 10 drafts after selling the book. So I try to be a perfectionist, I guess. I'm certainly obsessed with it. I won't let it go until I feel like I've got every drop out of it.
Yeah. Did those changes that you made on your tour, did they make it into the paperback, or was that just for your own satisfaction?
That was just for my own satisfaction. I didn't. I think if I'd asked to make more changes, with my publisher would have lost her mind, and my editor would have tried to talk me out of it. So I just let that go.
Okay. All right. Great. I just have one last question for you. You mentioned that you just sent a novel off to a reader yesterday. Are you able to talk at all about what you are working on right now, or?
It's a big book. It's about 700 manuscript pages.
It's, wow.
It's hard to describe. It's a story. It starts with these two boys in 1959 who are best friends and who wind up being in an accident And the source of that accident had to do with who their parents are. So it's it goes back in time and forward in time, sort of simultaneously. It switches back and forth. And for the first 300 or so pages, what I call book one, we follow these two boys through a few years of their lives and see how the accident affected each of them. It affected them in quite dramatic ways.
Mm-hmm.
And then in book two, skip forward a number of years and follow not only those two boys, now adults, but also characters with whom they interacted as boys and followed those lives. The first part, book one, is told in a fairly traditional narrative way, which is how I think we remember our youth. It seems all very densely connected.
Mm-hmm.
Book two is a novel in stories, and I think that's more the way we see our adult lives, fragmented and connected in looser ways.
Hmm.
And at the same time, it takes place over the last half of the 20th century, a few years into the 21st century, and I'm trying to also get at something about that time period in the United States. It's called The Tongue in Every Wound, which from Shakespeare, and it's the idea that if wounds could speak, what would they say? I think that goes right to the heart of what we're trying to do as fiction writers, give voice to those wounds, and in this case I'm trying to look at specific character wounds and also a country's wounds.
Huh, wonderful. Wow, that sounds like it's got a lot happening. How long did that take to write?
Well, I don't even know how to answer that. I started the major part, the first part, book one, I started in 2009. So
okay.
That's gone, that's taken me about 5 years. The stories in it, I've been writing for years.
Okay.
Some of them date back all the way to the 1980s. And I had a less cohesive idea back then of trying to write about individual lives in the context of what's going on nationally. So I've been working on it for a long time, one way or another.
Okay. Well, that sounds wonderful. Good luck with that. And that is all my questions. I'll just one more time repeat. Robert Boswell, author of Tumble Down, published by Grey Wolf, which went to paperback in September. Thank you so much for speaking with me today.
It was great talking to you.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Robert Boswell. You can learn more about his work at his website, robertboswell.com. Write the Book and The Radiator are supported in part by Calamity and Crows Trading Post, twisting fresh tie-dyes for individuals, businesses, and organizations with standards like eyeballs, Jerry Bears, peace signs, and their signature tie-dyed mule, custom artisan tie-dyes that rock. Contact Calamity and Crows Trading Post on Facebook. So this morning I reported to our local courthouse for jury duty. Maybe this is something you've been through yourself recently. While I was there, I wasn't able to do very much in between the active moments of jury questioning and selection. And so what I ended up doing was watching people and making mental notes about appearance and habits and speech. We don't get an opportunity to do that so often. Everybody's so busy rushing here and there. So it was interesting to be kind of stuck somewhere without a lot of entertainment. So your write the book prompt this week is to try to immerse yourself in a place with strangers and watch them. See if your characters might learn something from these people, something about how to dress, how to speak, how to walk, how to use their hands. I imagine you'll come up with new ways of presenting at least one of the characters you thought you already knew. Good luck with this exercise, and please listen next week for another. My other piece of advice for anyone looking for more than a prompt is to check out Robert Boswell's book on craft, The Half-Known World. It's excellent. If you are interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know they can stream it live at theradiator.org every Monday from 2 to 3. Archived episodes of Write the Book are also available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and Write the Book Radio Show on Facebook for updates. And you can also access the podcast and my new blog, The Silent G, by going to my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. I had a lot of fun over the weekend or end of last week, I interacted a little bit with the sports writer, Jeff Perlman. He invited me to write a guest post for his blog. And so you can get to that by going to my website and, going to the Silent G and then clicking on the post I wrote for him. It takes you to his website. So anyway, my website again is shelaughswithoutus.com. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. Do remember that The Radiator is here thanks to community support and involvement. More information about The Radiator is available online at theradiator.org. And this is Shayla Shapiro, and this has been Write the Book. You're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM, LP, Burlington, Vermont.